there's a really common way that people talk about their retirement, that they're busier than they ever were. And that's great for people who love to be busy. But I also think that there is a defensiveness. I'm still physically capable. I still matter. I'm still engaged. And I think my message is, if you want to sit on the couch and eat potato chips in your retirement, you can. That isn't happening because you're old. It's happening because you need a rest, or maybe because it's something that I enjoy doing.
Welcome to the only show that simplifies the complicated world of retirement planning while embracing life beyond the numbers.
Expect clear insights,
accessible tools,
expert interviews,
and actionable advice,
empowering you to use your values as a roadmap to your ideal retirement.
No MBA required.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Your Retirement Planning Simplified. I am Joe Curry, along with my co-host, as always, Lindsay Wilson. How are you, Lindsay?
I am great, Joe. We're in the swing of things here with our client reviews, so it's a busy time.
Yeah, so just thinking about how we're usually planning a little bit ahead, and now I'm probably making you a little bit nervous because we're doing these kind of last minute to get them out the next week.
Yes, this is true. That's okay. We'll make it through.
Yeah, that's right. So just a few more weeks of this, but hopefully we shouldn't miss any. We should get them all out.
Oh, yes.
So we had Sally Chivers on the show today, and we were talking about aging and ageism, which is an important topic, especially when you're approaching retirement, because we can start to get these thoughts that are kind of ingrained in us from ageism and thinking about how maybe retirement is more like the end, and how we have these stereotypes that we've built up for ourselves just based on societal views. So Sally's done a lot of work in this space. She's a professor at Trent University, and I'll let you do the whole bio, Lindsay, but she's also a client, which was fun to have her on and talk to a client. So that was great. But anyway, yeah, it was a really interesting conversation. We talk about ageism in workplaces. We also talk about it into retirement. So something a little bit different than we've talked about in the past. So hopefully it spices things up for you, our listeners.
Well, Sally is an award-winning professor, author, and podcast. And as Joe mentioned, she works as a professor at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario. And as host of Wrinkle Radio, her own podcast, she draws on decades of research to show that an aging population is nothing to fear.
Yeah. So with that, we can probably jump right in, Lindsay. Hi, Sally. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on. This is going to be a bit of a different topic for our show, but also very relevant. You have your own podcast, and you're talking about ageism and the topic of aging, which is very relevant to our listeners who are getting close to or in retirement. So I just want to start with, how did you come up with the idea for that topic for a podcast?
Yeah, my podcast is called Wrinkle Radio, and our tagline is "Don't panic, it's just aging." And I wanted to do that because in all of my research that I've done over a couple of decades, I've noticed how much we are encouraged to be scared of growing older. And yet, when I interview older people, I find out that there's a lot to look forward to. So I really wanted to take the conversations that I know we're having at the university and the research that we're doing and make sure that people in a wider public can learn about that and can add to it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, we talk to so many people approaching retirement, and there's a lot of different ideas about what retirement is. And I feel like one of the things that we do in here as our clients approach retirement is we're really talking about exploring what we're retiring to, as opposed to just thinking of it as retiring from work to that stage where we just get old and we sit around and don't do anything, or maybe we go to a beach, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the way it is, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe just stepping back before the podcast, just how did you get interested in this whole idea of aging just in general?
It's quite a story. I was 17 years old and I walked into the Calgary Public Library and I took off the shelf Margaret Lawrence's The Stone Angel. And I know in Ontario, everybody's been made to read that novel, so they hate it. I know that because I tried teaching it here and I was like, why don't people want to do this? But for me as a 17-year-old, I sat down and read this book from the perspective of a 90-year-old woman. And she's not even a very nice woman. It sounds naive, but I was 17. And I thought, I have actually never thought of the interior life of someone so much older than me. It really changed something in me. So that ever since then, like, I'd see someone on a bus who was older, and I'd think they're having those thoughts and feelings and memories. So that's really where my interest started.
Okay, very interesting. That's a pretty young age to be reflecting in that way too. Obviously, it sent you on a bit of a journey.
It did, yeah. I then went on to do my PhD, and I read another novel that was also from the perspective of an older character, and I thought, there is a pattern of Canadian authors talking about aging. So I really started it from that kind of what are people saying in novels perspective. And then gradually my research has gotten more concrete, looking at how nursing home care is organized, how age-friendly communities are designed, who they include, who they leave out.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about ageism in the workplace. So what are some common misconceptions or stereotypes that we can challenge as it relates to ageism in the workplace?
I think the biggest one, and it's still very front of mind because of how many people moved to work from home at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's about technology and the idea that older people are resistant to adapting technology, can't adapt technology, you know, like keep themselves on mute, all that kind of thing that, you know, when we were joking about Zoom. And there is something behind any kind of general conception like that. At the same time, if you look at the cohorts who are being criticized in that way, they actually have adapted to a ton of technology throughout the years that they've been working, right? Like even I'm 52, and when I started my PhD, the internet wasn't even a really big part of it. So I've had to get used to the internet and now posting my classes online. And I happen to be one of those quick adopters, you know, going kind of ahead of the curve, nothing to do with my age. So I think that's one of the biggest right now, the idea that everything should be functioning through these technologies that make us go faster and that older people can't keep up with that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just thinking about our business and the pandemic, how all of a sudden we're seeing everybody virtually for a period of time. It really had nothing to do with age for who did and didn't adopt to kind of those Zoom meetings that we were doing. It was more just kind of, I think, personalities. So,
yeah, my mom's in her 80s and she picked up Zoom very quickly. She moderates church services still and like nothing to do with her age. She's always been very adept at that. My father's in his 80s and does what he has to do through the computer, but I don't think it's his choice.
Yeah, we definitely have several clients in their 80s now who have chosen to stick with Zoom rather than coming into the office. So it's interesting. So how do different generations perceive and navigate age-related dynamics in the workplace?
There's this account. It's probably on TikTok, but I'll just boomer myself, even though I'm not a boomer. I'm not on TikTok. So I see it, I think, on Facebook. His name's Champagne Cruz, and he does these absolutely hilarious stereotype skits, right? So it's got like a Gen Z, a millennial, a Gen Xer, and we Gen Xers don't always make it into these. I'm a Gen X, right? Like a boomer, and enacts all of those stereotypes. I find it funny because it's so ridiculous what he's making fun of, and there's a seed of truth in it. And I think that what he, this Champagne Cruz, is picking up on is an idea within the workplace that it used to be the idea that millennials were lazy and didn't want to work hard, but now they're kind of situated as the anxious ones that still would like to work 4 day weeks, right? And the Gen Z as pushing back and being like, I'm not going to do that. And the Gen X are working like overnight and the boomer just sitting and laughing with his newspaper. That's the kind of scenario that gets laid out. I bring it up because if we start kind of resorting into those generational understandings, there's generational tension in the workplace. But another way to think about it is that someone in those kinds of Gen X years right now might have new caregiving responsibilities, for example, for an older parent at the same time as they're pulling their kids through whatever they might need support for. And they might really benefit from that stereotypical idea that Gen Z supposedly has, that if you need a break, you take a break, you do the work later. So I'm sort of giving two answers to you there, right? That there are these generational tensions that we have different work ethics and relationships to the idea that we ought to work or do work in a certain way. But there's actually a lot to learn from each other if we took a step back from the ageism that pervades those stereotypes.
So that's a really good point. And this is kind of a continuation of that. We talked a little bit before we came on air. And this is not to say that there isn't any companies who are an example of how we're fostering this intergenerational collaboration. But for companies to do that, is there a way you can think of for how we can be learning from each other and using that to our advantage?
Yeah, I think that there's a way that companies will build in mentorship programs. For example, so that like an older worker gets partnered with someone who's being onboarded to learn from the older worker. And that's helpful because you can honor the long-held wisdom and you can support someone new into the workplace. But I think an even better way to do it would be to think of that both ways. So that you could have people who are tech mentors, you know, people who are engagement mentors, and do it around topics rather than around ages, and then have people buy in so that you're not from the beginning setting up these ideas of seniority and junior that don't really play out in terms of knowledge and skill. So I think that's one way. And another thing I thought of, this question was about companies, and I started actually thinking about theater companies, right? Partly because I knew Lindsay is into theater, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not always a workplace. It can be an unpaid area, but it's an example of a place in our contemporary culture where there is a lot of intergenerationality, right? You have older actors playing older characters. You have stagehands. You have audience members. And so I was thinking about examples like that, or like the farmer's market, just the very few places where we actually have a range of generations who are valued for what they bring.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, this is a show about retirement, so we'll talk a little bit about retirement here. Mm-hmm. But what happens when older employees do retire? So when we're thinking about them leaving the workforce, I mean, there's years of wisdom and knowledge and experience leaving, and then there's potentially people coming in with a lack of experience. So what's happening in companies when that older generation, boomer generation, whoever it is retiring and that wisdom is leaving?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'll answer it from my own workplace of the university to start with, because even when I arrived 20 years ago, there was a discourse among the senior members that they needed to get out of the way. And the way that used to work in my workplace is if someone left, then there was a new line available that someone could be hired into. And I can think of many of my really older colleagues with integrity who stepped aside, and then there was no one to replace them. So it's not even just that they got replaced by someone younger who didn't have that historical memory, understanding of why processes were the way they were, and had maybe seen things done over and over again in these kinds of cycles, but also that they were replaced by part-time labor, right? So,
yeah,
you know, these different ways of working. But I do also want to emphasize the importance of historical memory. I'm noticing I'm now in that kind of senior chair around the department meeting table where I'm like leaning back in my rocking chair and being like, this is why we do it this way. Or, you know, I remember the second financial crisis in my career. And there's a confidence I have that, for example, that Trent University will navigate the very difficult waters that we're about to face in terms of funding, because I've seen it happen a few different times. But there's also often like a logic behind policies or processes that is forgotten when someone leaves, and then we end up doing that work again. We end up starting again. We end up trying. And yet it's very hard from where I sit not to stop some of my younger colleagues from going ahead and learning the lessons that I needed to learn, not just from being told. So it is a complicated scenario, but we do lose a lot. And at the same time, in a lot of workplaces, there's more money to hire people when the more senior employers go. So I'm not going to pretend that doesn't happen. I think that the approach to really consider is how to keep older employees engaged, even if not in full-time employment. There's all kinds of ways you can bring people back for activities as consultants And the way to do that effectively is to start valuing what people bring to the table well before they retire. Right? Yeah. Because if you're slowly nudging someone out because they haven't found their mute button, you're not going to get the generous return that you could after someone has left paid employment.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, with a lot of companies, its bottom line is also a focus. So I'm just thinking like bringing people in earlier, maybe just trying to think of other ways that could happen, right? But I think a lot of it probably comes down to people thinking about the bottom line, and we don't want to have too much overlap here. Oh, now we're paying you too much. So yeah, we're ready for you to go and we'll then hire. And like you said, it's kind of, there's more money there to hire people. That's great. But there's no passing of the knowledge or that the wisdom and picking up where the last person's left off. So there's a lot of things to consider there.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of graciousness on both sides to take what knowledge is offered and to decide to offer that knowledge. And we're right now really living in a burnout moment of a burnout culture. And that worries me in terms of exactly what you're talking about, because there's going to be a lot of situations where the second someone can retire, they're going to have to almost collapse, right? After all of this. And there's all kinds of reasons why that is the case right now. But that to me is the concern. So having some compassionate leave policies and flexible work arrangements that allow people to restore themselves before they hit retirement, I think could pay off in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people just do things, you know, the way it's always been done, 9 to 5, and we put in those hours or whatever it is, right? But, you know, unless you're customer facing, you know, the retail store has to be open certain hours. So maybe there's certain people have to be there. But other than that, flexible working, like that kind of thing makes sense. And I think we do see a bit more of it now since COVID. I think it is something that's on the radar, but still probably not mainstream. I was talking to a client yesterday and they said one of the best things that they did was instead of just retiring, they slowly decreased their hours for like 3 years in a row. And so that allowed them to transition to retirement. So it wasn't a kind of a shock to the system, and they had kind of figured out their routines when they were fully there. But it also kept them engaged at work. It helped them pass off their wisdom to the people who were taking over. And they felt like they still had a role and some purpose and worth while they were kind of still there. And it wasn't like a, okay, you're here or you're not here. So it's also something that can make a lot of sense for a lot of companies.
I know we have a clause in our collective agreement that allows for that, for faculty at Trent to go down to 50%, I believe. I can't remember the duration. And I think the benefit is that it doesn't affect your last 5 for your pension. I think that's why you're allowed to do it. And so it's really, really built in. And for exactly the reasons that you said, you know, you can continue teaching, someone else can start taking over a couple of courses. And then the benefit to the employee is, as you said, you don't have the shocking shift in routine. You know, like one day you were in meetings all day and the next day, no one would know if you got out of bed. Like, I think that's the feeling or the fear that people have about retirement.
Yeah, especially I think when you're talking about, you know, people who have worked hard in their career, like professors probably is a great example of that, or business owners, that's been their life and their identity, right? So to just turn that off overnight, it's not as easy as we might think. We all think of the dream of retirement, but that's not necessarily a good thing to make that shift that quickly.
Exactly.
So how do ageist ideas change how people think of themselves once they get into retirement?
That's a huge one. I think the dominant ageist idea is that we just decline and fall apart, and that that's what aging is. And of course, our bodies change over time. Sometimes they change when we're quite a bit younger too. There's all kinds of ways that that happens. But I'm not saying there aren't physical changes that come with age, but along with that, there's a sort of psychological ripening, let's say. There's all kinds of ways that our worldviews can become richer and deeper. And that's not part of the messaging that people who are going into retirement get. So how I think that plays out, there's a really common way that people talk about their retirement, that they're busier than they ever were. That's what people really like to say. And that's great for people who love to be busy. But I also think that there is a defensiveness in that. I'm still going. I'm still able. I'm still physically capable. I still matter. I'm still engaged. And I think my message is just, if you want to sit on the couch and eat potato chips in your retirement, you can. Like, that isn't happening because you're old. It's happening because you need a rest, or because you've always wanted to sit on your couch. I always use that example, right? Because that's never the figure that we get. And maybe because it's something that I enjoy doing. So I think that's one of the ways. And, you know, we're so valued in this kind of burnout culture by our productivity measured in this one way, right? Like what we bring to the workplace and how hard we work and deliverables that can feed into an ageist view of the self. Because it's one thing to value ourselves, like I value myself as a professor who has knowledge and does research, and you have all this wisdom and advice that you give people, and we both make our livings doing that, but we would still have that core set of competencies and values if we retired. So it's thinking about what parts of ourselves we really value and believe in that have stayed constant or developed through our lives that I think can fight against this ageist idea that we just stop mattering at a certain point.
Yeah, my old doctor, who's retired, he's been retired for quite a while now, but he also lives on my street. And when I'd moved there, I didn't realize that, but I seen him walking down the street. And anyway, so I don't talk to him to see what he was up to. He was carrying a textbook. So he would be, you know, around 80 years old. And he was just walking back from his friend's house who was dealing with some, I can't remember what it was, some kind of ailment. So he was over there just lending a helping hand to give him an idea of what he should be looking into and what he should be asking his doctor. And so for him, it was kind of like, even though he wasn't a doctor, his passion was still being able to help people live better lives. And so he was still kind of doing that and passing on that wisdom and guidance to some friends, even though he wasn't actually, he's not a practicing doctor anymore.
Yeah. And then he doesn't have to do all the paperwork and answer to like all those parts of the job that a lot of us would be happy to leave behind are gone. I think retirement doesn't have to be tied to age so tightly. And that is something we were talking before the show about this episode of Wrinkle Radio that I did with my colleague, Stephen Katz. And he talked about how retirement has changed. It's no longer, and it never really was actually, that people all got to just retire at 65. That's a really short historical window. And it's a really class-based window that people get to do that. But people could retire at 40. People could retire at 90 now. Retirement could last a lot longer than it used to. So I think we could try, and this is so important to the work that you do and the way that you do it, I think, to separate the idea of aging from the idea of retirement, right?
Yeah, that's a great point.
I'm borrowing from my retirement now, not just financially, but in terms of the kind of joy and day-to-day way I want to live my life. And that is thanks to the way that you approach your, I don't mind sharing that I am one of your clients. I hope that's okay to say,
thanks,
right?
Sally, absolutely.
That is what we both really value from you, is that tie to how we want to live our lives and thinking about that, not just starting when I turn 65 and I can retire, but starting at whatever age I was when I first walked into your office.
Yeah, which is great. And some people have a really hard time of thinking about what they really actually want. They've just kind of, this is what I do because I need to do it. But one of the things that we talk about with clients, especially when they're struggling to kind of think about, you know, what is this next step? What's purpose beyond work? Is like going back and journaling and reflecting on when you were a kid or a teenager and, you know, you couldn't do things because your parents, for whatever reason, didn't let you or didn't have the money or whatever it is. Like, go back, like, what are the things that you wanted to do? The things you said, I'm going to do that when I'm older and I can, but then you got a job and you had kids and you never ended up doing any of that stuff, right? So starting to think about those things, just because you're retiring or your later life doesn't mean you still can't have fun and do these things that you've dreamt about or were passionate about before.
Exactly.
Yeah. So age doesn't need to stop any of that, which is sad, but I think it's definitely a thing where people look at where they're at in their life and they say, oh, I can't do that anymore. I'm too old for that. And it's sad really to think, because in a lot of cases, it's not true.
I mean, there's so many stories in the art world of people who started their art practice in their 50s, in their 60s, in their 70s, like big Canadian novelists, none of which I can, of course, remember the name off the top of my head at the moment. And also people who come back to school and to university and take courses that they didn't take the first time around because they thought they had to take a degree that would lead to a specific job. But after retirement, people come and they study history and philosophy and English literature. And this is the argument I always try to make for funding the humanities, right? Is like, when you get down to what you really wanted to do, you want to pursue meaning. And that's what we learn in those subject areas.
Yeah, for sure. I think back probably when I was in high school, thinking about what I wanted to do for school, one of the things I was really interested in doing was pursuing like a history degree. But I always thought, well, like, what am I going to do with that? Mm-hmm. Something I never really did, but doesn't mean it's something I can't go back and do when I, you know, beyond this work or
exactly
just as an interest, right? Yeah, no, that's a really good point.
Mm-hmm.
And so your colleague, Stephen, when you guys were chatting, you guys mentioned kind of an alternate retirement or thinking about retirement differently. And Stephen was talking about like fantasy bands and kind of being like the rock star later in life. So maybe you could just touch on a little bit of what you guys were talking about and how, you know, that kind of plays into this idea of what we're talking about, how retirement doesn't have to be what people think of when they think of retirement.
Yeah. In that episode, we were talking about boomers who wanted to be rockers since they first saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And then finally, when they retire, they have the money to buy the guitar and fit out their rec room. And there are whole businesses designed towards putting together a band. And you learn together over a period of time and you get to perform in a show. And then some of those bands take off and continue. I'm not sure that I have hit huge, right? But they continue as both social groups and as the kind of being a rock and roller. And that is not your grandma's retirement, right? Is the way you might think about it, right? It's not that idea of like sitting on the rocking chair to kind of play on the rocking or whatever we used to think that retirement was. It's like, okay, now I'm going to do just like what you were saying, that thing I wanted to do when I like first air guitared or played the drums in my parents' basement. And they said, like, we are not having you be a long hair and like do whatever the language was.
Yeah.
But there is this understandable parental concern for kids wanting to take non-lucrative career paths that can shut off not just the profession of being a musician, but even people thinking they might do music for fun. So that's part of what we were talking about. And he situated that in the idea of retirement as a kind of becoming, being reinvented, that there isn't as much of the talk anymore of you need to have a hobby, because retirement could be work. It could be volunteering. It could be sitting on the couch, you know, eating potato chips. It could be travel. It's not just the kind of like learning woodworking because I'm trying to fill the time and my wife needs to get me out of the house, right? Which was the, the sort of story before. And now my wife needs to get me out of the house. And so I'm going to go become a rock star.
Yeah, which I love. I love that. How can individuals empower themselves to resist internalizing ageist beliefs in retirement?
That's a really good question. And I think it's looking at the messaging around you. And whenever you notice, and this is on social media, it's on TV advertisements, it's in comedy, whenever you notice messages that are trying to make you afraid, just ignore those, right? Like just tune those out. I think that that is the number one message, that you're not a burden on society unless society is structured very differently than we actually believe in Canada, right? Like we do still have a public healthcare system and a social contract among us. And there is this messaging about healthcare costs and aging that isn't even accurate if you crunch the numbers. Like older adults are not the leading cost of healthcare costs. So that's what I'm saying, is just tune that out. And also the messages that you should be doing any particular list of advice, right? The five things you need to do to stay healthy, or the six things that are going to help you prevent dementia, or those are all trying to sell you a product. And instead, exactly as we've talked about a few times, and as you do in your advising, get down to your values. And if your values are physical fitness, then you might want to look at the 10 tips for how to stay active and think about how to adjust that to 65-year-old knees, right? Because they're not going to do what your 30-year-old knees did. If you're looking for models, there are these blue zones. Netflix had a documentary about it that have a list of ways that a place can be structured to support longevity and not just living long, but having a quality of life longer. And just remember, you can't take one of those. So just eating more salmon, like, great idea, but it's not going to fulfill everything. One of the parts of the blue zones that I think we don't pay attention to when people are talking about importing it is the kind of imagery that's around us. In blue zones, there isn't just a cult of youth. We are valuing older adults, or they, we are not actually, very much not. But in blue zones, older people are revered and are models. And I don't know how you can do that for yourself, but you could look for those kinds of examples too, because I think it takes a lot of courage to fight ageism in yourself, a lot more than to point it out when it's about other people. But when you look at the way you're thinking about your own body and your own life, and you're questioning your own value because you're growing older, that's a very brave and difficult thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm only 39 right now, so I'm approaching middle age, I guess. But my thoughts have always been that I'm just going to keep doing things like I did when I was 16 or 17, like what I want to do for fun. Like, I still go on snowboarding trips. I still went bungee jumping with my wife last year. It's still like, I just don't stop doing those things that, like, play, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that will work out long term, but my thought has always been that as long as I continue to do those things, like, I don't need to stop because I hit a certain age. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I still have a young mindset, and I hope that continues to be the way. So that's very anecdotal, and, like, there's no evidence on that, but that's kind of just been my approach and how I hope that will help me continue to stay and feel young and not worry about aging. So we'll see.
And there is evidence about play. I think that was a really good word that you used, like, that play can help combat all kinds of the supposed problems that come with aging. And on top of doing the things you've always done, staying open to doing new things that you've never done before. And I mean, I've watched you start a podcast and, like, rearrange the way your business is structured, right? Like, you strike me as someone very open to doing that. And I think that's another strong ageist message, right? Like, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. You sure can. The neural pathways are still there. In fact, we learn more and more about how we learn as we grow older. So we become better students, right? Like, let me tell you, those retired people who come back to Trent are my favorite students because they do reading and they help and they bring a lot of knowledge. So I think that's it. You may decide that bungee jumping is going to rattle your bones too much at a certain point in life. You may not, but there might be something else that you had been afraid to do. And all of a sudden you think, no, now's the time. I have enough courage. I have enough wisdom. I have enough money, whatever the factors are.
Yeah, exactly. I think you've kind of touched on this a little bit, and probably when you were talking about the blue zones, but in an ideal scenario, how would you envision a society that embraces and celebrates aging?
The blue zones are a good example, but we can't all live in a blue zone because they also have to be geographically located in a certain way. So I would picture it as determinedly intergenerational. Right now, we live in a really age-segregated way so that if we encounter older adults, it tends to be within the family or maybe within a workplace. So fostering intergenerational spaces, those places I was talking about in the answer about companies as well. And when I think about it, I mean, faith communities are often good at this, but a lot of people aren't part of faith communities at the moment. Like, Peterborough Farmers Market is a great example. So I could say that from the location where we are. Theater, lots of arts organizations, even some sports groups. I feel like you know a lot more about this than me, but I'm going to say it anyway. Even an organization like the Peterborough Petes, like, it's not just the people on the ice and the junior players coming up, but there's, like, managers and volunteers and, you know, it's a whole kind of organizational structure. And just really deliberately, I think if we're thinking structurally, making sure we're building the containers for those kind of intergenerational spaces. And then on the individual level, you know, when you're going about your day-to-day, think about, like, who did I talk to today, like, outside of my age range? And how might I change that? Like, I don't really like parties. So when I go to a party, I usually go and talk to the oldest person in the room and they have the best stories. And that's another way that I've gotten interested in aging. I also don't have kids. And so I love when I get to see my friends' kids because it's just like this fascinating other way of being in the world. Like a 13-year-old has a lot of wisdom that we've lost. A 6-year-old has a lot of like joy and far less judgment than a 13-year-old or a 52-year-old. And that's nice when it happens within family, but I think we need to really be pushing beyond family structures for that. And that can be you're walking on the path outside and you stop to talk about like the cardinal that's singing in the tree, right? And just really thinking about, are you gravitating to people who you think are in your age and stage? Or are you open to connecting with people across generations?
Yeah, no, I love that. Like, that's probably a great place to end. But before we sign off, can you tell our listeners where they can find your podcast, where they can learn more about you or get in contact, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. So Wrinkle Radio, it's on all the podcatchers like Apple and Spotify. You can also find it at sallychivers.ca. And there you'll find transcripts and show notes so that if you want to be able to read along or learn more about anything that we talk about. And then you can find me easily at Trent University on their website if you want to reach out and talk to me about any of these topics or about Wrinkle Radio.
That's perfect. And we'll make sure we get all that in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Sally.
Thank you.
Investment services are provided through Matthews & Associates Investments of Aligned Capital Partners Incorporated, an approved trade name of Aligned Capital Partners, Inc., ACPI. Only investment-related products and services are offered through ACPI/Matthews & Associates Investments of ACPI and covered by the Canadian Investor Protection Fund. Tax planning, financial planning, and insurance services are provided through Matthews & Associates. Matthews & Associates is an independent company separate and distinct from ACPI/Matthews & Associates Investments of ACPI. Matthews & Associates are not licensed tax professionals, and you should consult with your tax advisor before acting on any recommendations.
Visit retirementplanningsimplified.ca and join the Retirement Planning Simplified community,
where we explore the complicated world of retirement planning while embracing life beyond the numbers.
As a member of our community, you'll receive insights,
tips,
and the latest retirement planning tools
straight from us to you.